Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a bit of a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. One of the men who is in the front lines of that war, both observing and helping us all to understand what is afoot, is Dr. Barry Rubin. He is the director of the Gloria Center, which stands for Global Research in International Affairs at Herzliya and Israel, and we catch up with him in Israel, I think, for the first time in the new year. Barry, happy new year to you. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Well, thank you. I hope it's a happy year.
I do indeed as well. Let's start with some of the things that might portend otherwise. Since we last talked, I believe, Barry, we've had a new Sharia-conforming constitution adopted in Egypt. One example of sort of the rise of Islamism in your neighborhood. You follow these things closely. What does it mean for Egypt? What does it mean for Israel and, for that matter, the region?
Well, first of all, I just want to say, because the listeners will come up against this, that the constitution itself is not, it's not that extreme or Islamist the way it's worded. The point is that it allows certain institutions to interpret what's right and what's acceptable, and therefore gives them the power to impose Islamism and Sharia, but not because it's explicitly the constitution, but because of how they can lay down laws and so on. I won't get into it in any more detail than that, but I do think it's important to understand. Well, the next step, of course, is the election of a new lower house of parliament, and we'll have to see how well the Islamist party is doing that. But finally, only now is the Egyptian government beginning to take hold to deal with economic and other problems. And I mean, I think we can expect what we've expected, which is that, you know, that it will institute an increasingly radical and repressive regime in the country, one in which Christians can't function, in which women lose their existing rights, and so on. And there are lots of indications of that. For example, the way that Mursi put together his cabinet, the subtle but growing pressures on the press and every aspect of life. But slow, it's subtle. It should be understood. That's where these people are not stupid. But that patience is not the same as moderation. They don't have to yell Allahu Akbar and you know, start waving swords. They're doing it step-by-step manner.
Right. It's a boa constrictor, perhaps. Barry Rubin, let me ask you this. There is now, as you know, an effort underway in the United States to send further arms, fighter aircraft and tanks, to this government in Egypt. Is that advisable, in your view?
My problem is the fact that what the policy has landed us here. Once you're here, should people try to stop it in Congress as a show of how uneasy they are? Yes. Will they succeed in stopping it? No. It is important for the United States to maintain good relations with Egypt. It is important for the United States to maintain good relations with Egypt's army. This is rational diplomacy. But the problem is that having, you know, helped get into a situation in which there's an extremist government, in which that things are not going to remain static. That government's going to name the generals. It's going to control the military. Those arms are not going to be used by military officers to contain and constrain the Islamist government. They're going to become the possession of the Islamist government. So it's basically that by its previous policies, the Obama administration has landed in a mess. But I know that the response is going to be, you know, well, in a sense, it doesn't matter to debate it because the arms will be sent. The argument will be that the U.S. must maintain good relations with an important country, that that Mursi is the president. But that's not enough, because as they say, I mean, who are those arms most likely to be used against? And they're not most likely to be used in systematic repression of Salafists and protection of the rights of Christians. They're not likely
that's
to
for
be
sure
used against extremists. So, look, you say that, and I say that, maybe your listenership says that, but that is a view that simply does not exist in the establishment, in the mass media, to a ridiculous extent, that we're all sort of just crazy in thinking that the Muslim Brotherhood may actually be a radical, you know, group. I mean, it's that's the state of the debate.
Yeah, well, you have written the book literally on the subject, Dr. Barry Rubin, The Muslim Brotherhood, the Organization and Policies of a Global Islamist Movement. I would tend to defer to you on just how radical and how much these weapons are likely to be put to the service of harming Israel, not repressing Salafists. But let me move quickly to another of the flashpoints adjacent to Israel's border, Syria. We've had, again, since we talked, Barry Rubin, the spectacle of the United States government declaring a designated terrorist organization as one of the elements of the so-called Syrian opposition, al-Nusra, only to have the rest of the opposition embrace these guys and say we're all al-Nusra. Is it likely, in your estimation, that should we persist in our present policy course, we are likely to bring an Islamist government, at best Muslim Brotherhood, at worst maybe al-Qaeda or a designated terrorist organization of another stripe, to power in Bashar Assad's stead? And what will that mean for, again, our interests as well as Israel?
Well, basically, yes, but I should stress, the Salafists are weak and disorganized. They're not going to take over in Syria any more than they're going to take over in Egypt. The issue is the Muslim Brotherhood. They're well-organized, they're well-disciplined, they're well-armed, and they're united. And the Salafists become, number one, a source of like terror and oppression against people, of anyone who doesn't go along. And two, a pressure group on the Muslim Brotherhood to be tougher. I'm saying that there's going to be a government in Syria which is likely to be controlled largely by the Muslim Brotherhood. That's a bad thing for everybody's interest. So the answer, of course, is that the Muslim Brotherhood are really moderate and they're going to protect from the Salafists. You know, and this is just absurd. I mean, it would be like saying, you know, that one had this support of the Stalinists, the communists in the Soviet Union because they were going to protect against the anarchists and the later the Trotskyists. I mean, you know, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, one of the architects of this policy, as you point out in a terrific piece about the four horsemen of the Obama administration's apocalypse, is John Brennan, who the president has recently designated, as you know, to become the next director of Central Intelligence Agency. You've described him as the father of the pro-Islamist policy. How bad an idea is this nomination?
I don't know if I could think of a worse one. I mean, it's true on several levels. First of all, yes, Brennan is, I think, by far more than any other individual, the creator of the idea that Muslim Brotherhood is good, that it's moderate, that it's going to be protection against the Salafists. He's written it explicitly. He's also written that the U.S. must show Iran that it respects Iranian interests, and that's the way to solve the problem with Iran. I mean, it couldn't be worse. And, for example, although he certainly supports contacts with Hezbollah, he has, in private, said that he also wants to negotiate with Hamas. So it's sort of like take the worst possible person you could and elevate him in power. But even aside from this, the question is what possibly would lead one to believe that Brennan should be head of the CIA? He has no great experience, knowledge, or anything about any other part of the world. In other words, even if you wanted to make him head of the CIA for the Middle East, or doing something in the Middle East, this man is going to be dealing in Latin America and Africa and Asia and Europe and every other aspect of the world. Now, I think that does say something about, first of all, Obama's support for people who he knows and who he feels agrees with him and who, you know, he can rely on. But really, this is absurd, even from Obama's point of view, even from his own interests, because he's not going to have somebody who's going to be helpful on these other issues. But it's just terrible, 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 and it shows he's doubling down in the second term. It also shows his priority Well, and it also shows his priority on the systems policy.
Yeah, well, and this, Barry, I've got to wrap up, I'm afraid, but this really makes the point very nicely that for many reasons, both within his area of putative competence and in all of these other areas where he has not demonstrated competence, John Brennan is not the right man for the CIA. We appreciate very much the chance to talk with you. We'll try to do so again early next week before the upcoming Israeli election. Barry Rubin, thank you very much for the work you do at the Gloria Center and for your terrific book, Israel, An Introduction. We'll talk with you again next week. Next up, Morgan Roach of the Heritage Foundation joins us to talk a bit about Mali and the Obama administration's seeming double standard with respect to Islamists. Straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
This hurricane season, coastal residents in the southeast and the Gulf states are urged to prepare for the uncertain conditions they may encounter in the aftermath of a major storm and make their annual contingency plans. In addition to other emergency essentials, the American Red Cross and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security recommend residents keep a diversified emergency wallet that includes cash and traveler's checks. American Express traveler's checks provide an extra measure of financial safety and security. Keeping traveler's checks and a supply of cash in small bills offers storm victims payment options to make necessary purchases. Traveler's checks never expire, providing a secure payment method whenever emergencies occur, this year and in the future. Unlike cash, they're refundable if lost or stolen. American Express traveler's checks are available at banks, credit unions, and American Express Travel Service locations across the Gulf Coast and Southeast regions. For more information, please visit www.americanexpress.com/travelerschecks.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Morgan Roach. She is a research associate in the Heritage Foundation's Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom. She specializes on matters involving Africa, the Middle East, and transatlantic relations. And we're very happy to have you with us, Morgan. One of the issues, of course, that we've been tracking here is the development of a very distinct Islamist problem, specifically one associated with Al-Qaeda in northern Mali. And the French government has recently taken it upon itself, putatively as kind of the leading element in a West African initiative, but nonetheless with its own forces, including now apparently both air attacks and forces on the ground, to intervene to prevent this Islamist cancer from spreading further in Mali. Tell us what's happening in Mali at the moment, as you understand it, and the role the French think they might be able to play.
Well, Frank, thanks for having me today. When we discuss France's involvement in Mali in particular, we need to put this sort of in the framework that Mali is a former colony of France.
Right.
Mali became independent in 1960, but ever since then, France is still considered Mali and its other colonies and on the continent sort of it's near abroad. It feels, you know, it has, you know, an obligation to still maintain some sort of presence, you know, for better or for worse. And what we're seeing on the ground right now is France's determination to prevent Mali from becoming an Islamist state, particularly as we've seen rather rapidly this coalition of Islamist groups move south. Very quickly, they occupied the northern part of Mali last spring, and you know, now they're making, you know, headway towards the capital, and France is attempting to stem this. Now, right now, France has deployed about 2,500 troops. They're on their way now. Last week, France deployed air assets, bombing particular targets, preventing an Islamist move north. However, this did not stop these individuals or these militants from claiming Diaboli, a central Malian town well south of the north-south demarcation line.
And to the extent that the French may find themselves with a rising tide of these Islamists, despite ratcheting up their military operations, do you think they have the stomach for a protracted campaign? And what role will the West Africans, if any, be playing?
Well, I've seen two sort of different narratives coming out of Paris. You know, President Hollande said that, you know, the French forces will be there until as long as is necessary, which, quite frankly, could take a very long time. I don't think we're going to see this situation go away anytime soon. But the French foreign minister said that, you know, this operation would, you know, be over in a matter of weeks. So I think there is a little bit of inconsistency on the French political side. West African forces are preparing to go in. I think many in the region, ECOWAS in particular, had been fighting for a UN resolution stating that a military force or a military training force would be sent to Mali to eventually, you know, retake the north. However, you know, this UN resolution is sort of, you know, mute now because the French have unilaterally intervened. And so it's a game changer.
And to the extent that the United States has been supportive of the French in this campaign, at least at the rhetorical level, there are indications that we are helping in other more tangible ways as well. What is your understanding, Morgan Roach, of the Heritage Foundation? Is the U.S. doing to enable or at least backstop the French military effort?
Well, Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta and, you know, State Department spokesmen have stated that, you know, the United States does support France in this. However, we have no interest in putting boots on the ground. And I think, you know, I don't think that is an option right now. What is an option, however, and what we are doing and should be doing are providing intelligence, you know, air transport and logistical support. I think the United States can be very productive in this. However, at the same time, France has obviously, you know, declared that it, you know, it wants to take the lead, and it is taking the lead.
Mm-hmm. The concern that I have about this is not that we're trying to stop the rise of an Islamist entity in a strategic part of Africa. Morgan Roach, as much as it's that it seems so completely at odds with the efforts we're simultaneously making as a U.S. government to bring about an Islamist entity in a strategic part of the Middle East, namely in Syria. Do you see this as a bit of a disconnect and one potentially of considerable trouble to us?
Well, I think you bring up a very, very good point in stating this. Syria is obviously a very, very difficult situation, and one in which the United States in particular has sort of farmed this job out to the United Nations, which obviously has not turned out very well. Assad is still there, and we see a lot of nefarious individuals roaming around in Syria right now waiting to take advantage of the security vacuum, if they obviously many have already. And so France, I think, has really leapt upon the opportunity to take an easier road. I am not necessarily downplaying the severity of Mali, but obviously Syria has been a problem for a longer time. I think that France obviously has, you know, colonial ties to Mali, and so it sees it as more of a priority for them. But it's also, I think, one that's more manageable and, quite frankly, you know, less ugly.
Yeah.
Something that they can control.
Well, I understand the differences. I'm more interested in sort of the similarities between what those who aspire to rule Syria seek and what those who are seeking to take over Mali may have in mind. But let me ask you about something else, Morgan Roach, before we run out of time with you. We have, of course, the French taking on this this challenging task at a moment when, in their own country, they have a non-trivial Islamist problem as well. In fact, the French have something on the order of 750 enclaves that are known as no-go zones that are effectively Sharia observing entities within metropolitan France. To what extent does that represent, as you understand it, potentially a fifth column problem for the French internally, and most especially a threat of terrorism in response to what France is doing in Mali?
Well, as you know, France has a very, very large Muslim population, obviously, you know, a very large Algerian population and African population in general. And we've seen, you know, across France, in particularly, you know, right outside of Paris in these banlieues, you know, Islamist extremism and, you know, radical language has been allowed to foment. And, you know, France, of course, has a very, very severe form of secularism known as laïcité. It doesn't necessarily translate into what the United States wouldn't necessarily refer to as secularism, but it is nevertheless, you know, comparable. And I think France has been battling this for, you know, this rise of Islamism for quite some time. And at the same time, though, France does have hold dear this concept of, you know, multiculturalism, but balancing this as with their form of laïcité or secularism is yet to be seen.
Well, we will be following this with considerable interest and apprehension, I must say. Morgan Roach, we appreciate you taking a few minutes to explain what is afoot in Mali, what the French think they can do there, what the United States is hoping to get out of the effort, and what may be some of the longer-term implications for the French, not least. Thank you for the work you do at the Heritage Foundation. We look forward to visiting with you in the future. Happy New Year.
Frank.
Next up, we'll have Jim Hansen joining us, our special operator. We'll talk about special operations in Mali, Afghanistan, and the impact of uncertainty in America's military. Straight ahead.
First line of defense in the war of ideas. Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Confirmation conversion syndrome is a well-known phenomenon in official Washington. Chuck Hagel, President Obama's choice to be the next Secretary of Defense, however, seems to have a particularly bad case of the disease. The former senator is telling his colleagues that he doesn't believe practically any of the things the record indicates he has long advocated. Now, he strongly supports Israel, a country he previously routinely criticized. Now, he favors sanctions he previously mostly opposed on Iran, and doesn't like terrorist groups he previously wanted to engage. Expect more of this flim-flammery in his upcoming hearing. The question is, will senators reward it by turning the Pentagon over to a man with well-established and very problematic beliefs just because he is willing to tell them now whatever they want to hear? This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedomradio.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Jim Hansen. He is a former special operator in the United States Army, a Ranger, a man we visit with regularity to talk about many of the public policy, national security issues of our time, but from a somewhat unique and certainly very important perspective, that of the guys with the boots on the ground. And Jim Hansen, we've been talking in the program about some boots that the French are now putting on the ground in Mali. Special operations units apparently are now engaging in ground combat as we speak. And of course, there have been aircraft operations, aerial attacks, and so on. What do you think is the likelihood that this will end well from the French point of view in light of what they're up against, the likely staying power of the French, for example, the ability even to sustain forces over a period of time by the French?
Well, one thing I find interesting is the number of places that the French have pretty much unilaterally intervened in over the past, 10 to 20 years. And the relative lack of furor over that as compared to the furor over what used to be Bush's unilateral interventions all over. And I think the French are really doing what the UN was meant to do. They actually will take a humanitarian nightmare, and instead of just wringing their hands about it, they'll send the Foreign Legion, they'll send commandos, they will send their military to take it down. And to some extent, they're a regional sheriff, especially in Africa, you know, as compared to U.S. as the global policeman. So I don't know, you know, it's tough to say what would constitute success for them in Mali. The difficulty always being, what are you actually trying to do? Are you nation building? Are you stopping a humanitarian nightmare? Are you fighting the spread of Islamism? You know, there's a number of things that really all have to happen and all would determine whether or not they're successful. I think it's impressive that they do it, and I think we are quite likely to do a little bit more joining with them in efforts like this.
Well, we certainly seem to be joining them, at least to some extent, with some of our logistical support and intelligence in the Mali campaign. And it will be interesting, as you say, Jim, to see how extensive the French involvement becomes, especially if it turns out that that you can't simply sustain a whack-a-mole kind of response to these Islamists. But I'm also interested in, you know, how we're dealing with Islamists, notably the Taliban, in Afghanistan at the moment. And you've been following this very closely. Of course, many of your comrades in arms are still engaged there. Jim, tell us about the likelihood that we're going to find dramatically reduced numbers of forces left there, perhaps long before the nominal end date. And most especially, I'd just be very interested in your view as a former special operator. Can we sustain safely and effectively a very small footprint of special forces guys in Afghanistan without them becoming essentially, well, maybe hostages, at worst, KIA, people who will be in a kind of Fort Apache situation?
Yeah, well, we're hitting the end game of Obama's war-ending crusade. You know, he wanted to end the war in Iraq before we'd won it. He wanted to end the war in Afghanistan, regardless of whether that was a win or a loss. And in the end, gave us the foe surge with no real plan to ever even try to achieve victory. So now I think he's looking for an exit that doesn't look like an abject cut and run. It is that. There is no question that's what it is. We have absolutely no chance that the Afghans can provide anything vaguely resembling security. The Taliban will be taking over large swaths of the country. And like you said, at this point, they're talking about leaving such a small number of troops behind that they become nothing but a target of American imperialism. So we'd almost be better off with zero, you know, and simply doing covert operations than leaving just one small group or two, you know, in a couple of places, attempting to prop up the Karzai regime and, you know, put a good face on what is one of the most glaring losses in our military history. So I think you're right that they will be targets, and I don't know that they can achieve anything worth achieving.
Jim Henson is our guest. He is a former special operator in the United States Army. He is currently a guy who can be found posting at the blog site best known as black5.net. He is a man that we regularly turn to, as do others, for the insights of kind of the boots on the ground perspective. And Jim, one of the things that you've written about recently at black5.net is the seeming double standard of some on the left when it comes to President Obama's counterterrorism practices that bear an uncanny resemblance to, at least in part, to those of George W. Bush that they vilified. I'm interested in sort of that double standard, but also particularly the point that you've made that there are real liabilities, risks associated with failing to capture and interrogate some of these terrorists as opposed to simply whacking them from drones. Talk about those two aspects of your current thinking.
Well, I mean, the extrajudicial killings, which is the term the left put into vogue to discuss anything that President Bush did, are expanded to an unprecedented degree under President Obama. And, you know, there was all that furor over a very small number of terrorists who got waterboarded. you know, and just to remind people, I was waterboarded. So is pretty much anybody who's been through the Army or the Navy SEER program, you know, the survival training program. And they just lost their minds over enhanced interrogation, which was being mean to people and asking them questions to try and stop a terror attack. Well, Obama was so outraged by that, he decided it's better to just blow them up. And I just am absolutely incapable of understanding how somehow that is not more outrageous than pouring water on somebody's face. You don't give them a trial. You don't give them a lawyer. You don't even ask them any questions. You don't even verify, you know, beyond President Obama's personal kill list, which he likes to maintain, that this is someone that we have a problem with. No, it's him alone. He makes the decision. He's the decider. And then people die, including American citizens. Now, the bottom line is I would support almost all of that, but I don't understand why that's not held to the same degree of scrutiny and outrage that President Bush's policies were, and it's just a sign of rank hypocrisy on the left and in the media.
I couldn't agree with you more. Jim, one other thing that you've written about recently, which is really important, is something that a guy who's been inside the belly of the beast understands perhaps better than most of the rest of us. What is it doing to the United States military that they are being subjected to the immense uncertainty about the resources that they will have as a result of this budget exercise, sequestration, and so on?
Well, do you have a job? Are your benefits going to be cut? You know, will you have health insurance? Is your retirement pay secure? I think those things alone cause people to consider, should they reenlist? You know, should the best and brightest among our serving military consider that the rewards they've earned are going to be delivered? And I think what we've seen is a fairly high level of lack of concern by the current administration and essentially by Congress, because they can't get their own house in order. They're scared to touch any of the third rails, you know, of the hungry bird mouths clamoring for their entitlements. Consequently, oh, defense is evil. Yeah, well, no, defense gives all those other hungry birds a place to sit and clamor for their entitlements. So it is killing the morale and killing the ability of us to retain the best people we have, and will continue to do so for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and it can only be made worse by what it's doing to the military industries that make it possible for those guys to do their job, assuming they'll stay in to do that. We appreciate your insights on this, Jim, needless to say, and the work you're doing at Black5.net and APSEO. Jim Hansen, again, our guest, Master Sergeant, Special Operations, United States Army, retired. Thank you for joining us, sir, as always. We'll look forward to talking with you again in the near future. In the meantime, we'll get on with Diana West, who will give us her insights into foreign penetration of the U.S. media and what it might mean for you. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Do you see that doggy in the shelter?
Hi, I'm Buddy, that adorable puppy you adopted from the Humane Society.
Meow. I'm Whiskers, a fluffy kitty, just waiting for someone to love me.
When you adopt a pet, we hope your new furry friend will become a cherished member of your family. And as Buddy and Whiskers will tell you, the key to success is following the rules to love by.
Woof, that's right. Please give me food, water, and exercise every day. To stay healthy, I need the same kind of things you need.
Talk to me. I like hearing your voice.
You're my best friend. Please don't stay mad at me or lock me up as punishment. Remember, I'm probably going to live 10 to 15 years, so take care of me when I get old.
One day you'll need someone to take care of you, too.
A message from the Montgomery County Humane Society. Visit www.mchumane.org for the complete rules to love by.
Be your best friend for life.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, the Threat to America at amazon.com.
Hi, I'm Casey Kane. You would think that as NASCAR's 2004 Rookie of the Year, I get my biggest thrill driving fast. But it's off the racetrack that I get one of life's greatest rewards, helping others through volunteer service. Working with kids is one way that I try to make a difference. The first time I visited chronically ill children in the hospital, I found out just how rewarding volunteering could be. By giving a little of my time, it brightened their day. I was so inspired that I started my own foundation to help sick children and kids without an opportunity to have a better chance at life. Through volunteer service, you learn things about the people you're helping, and you find out a few things about yourself. Volunteering is a rush, just like taking the checkered flag. Go to volunteer.gov to find out what drives you.
This is President George W. Bush. USA Freedom Corps has a volunteer opportunity that's just right for you. Visit volunteer.gov. When you help your neighbor, you help your nation.
So what's the deal? You gonna get a job now or what?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
Why are you so distant? Are you not happy to see me?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org, brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. One of the high points of my week and yours, I'm sure, is our regular visit with Diana West in this block. She is, of course, the syndicated columnist whose extraordinary writing is really required reading in Washington, D.C. Her book, The Death of the Grown-Up, a bestseller, her forthcoming book, sure to be one, American Betrayal. And Diana West, one of the things that is symptomatic of our betrayal, I think, is the evident indifference of those responsible for the systematic penetration of America's mass media by foreign governments or foreign powers of other kinds. And I know that you've thought hard about this, and I'd like to visit with you about a couple of examples, perhaps starting with what I call Al Gorzira, the merger of Al Jazeera, Qatar's propaganda arm, with the current TV network established by former Vice President Al Gore. Give us sort of an update, if you would, on how problematic that transaction is.
Yes. Well, the closer you look at Qatar and Al Jazeera and this new Al Jazeera America enterprise, the more you do realize that it is indeed the government of Qatar buying into American homes. And this is problematic because there is no freedom of the press in Qatar, and it has masqueraded through Al Jazeera, particularly Al Jazeera English, which is what most Westerners see, as just another point of view. But when you actually drill down on the facts of how journalism, how freedom of speech do not exist under that system in that emirate, you begin to realize this is a foreign policy arm of the Qatari government, which is closely aligned with the aims of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, it's not just aligned with the aims. It is enabling the Muslim Brotherhood, among other Islamists, to advance the kind of territorial conquests and jihadist agendas that we've been talking about elsewhere in the program. And I think this is really what's so stunning is this is a foreign government owned and operated political warfare instrument, and there seems to be very little attention, let alone objection, being expressed by the government, despite laws on the books about foreign influence operations having at a minimum to disclose that that's what they're about, let alone this idea that foreign investors can simply purchase their way into some 40 million homes by some count. Diana, moving along, you have written, and we talked about a bit last week, but I'd like to sort of get an update from you on another example of this phenomenon among conservative outlets, specifically Fox News and the other outlets owned by the News Corp Corporation. Give us a sense of what that's about and its practical implications.
Yes, it's a very important story. And indeed, I would argue that the News Corp example is actually more dangerous to our understanding of world events, of the struggles we're engaged in, than the Al Jazeera buy. Even though Al Jazeera is somewhat disguised as a journalistic operation, I think the more we look at it, the more we will understand it as a Qatari arm, an arm of the Qatari, an arm of the Muslim Brotherhood. There is at least a certain level of open understanding. It's 100% government propaganda arm moving into America. I think that will be easy to put over. However, in the News Corp example, it's a much murkier kind of situation, but it is completely shrouded in silence at this point. News Corp is part-owned, a small block, but a potent block, 7%, by a senior member of the Saudi dictatorship. This is Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, and he is portrayed as an independent actor, a world globe-trotting, fabulously rich businessman who happens to be part of the Saudi family. But understanding the dynastic structure of the Saudi monarchy, he is very close. His uncle is the king. His first cousin is the interior minister. He is put in the family tree of the Saudi ruling family. So he's not just your garden variety rich man who happens to be from Saudi Arabia.
And more to the point, Dinah West, what he's about is consistent with what has been kind of the leitmotif of the government of Saudi Arabia, despite its profession of support for us and its help in some areas to us. Nonetheless, it has also been playing a double game, very much along the lines of Qatar, in terms of enabling, underwriting, in some cases arming our jihadist enemies.
Well, yes, a financial powerhouse of jihad is Saudi Arabia. And more to the point, Al-Walid himself has spent fabulous sums of money in support of Palestinian suicide bomber families, for example, going back to 2002 when he actually donated $27 million to that very cause. He's donated $500,000 that year to CARE here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Council on American Islamic Relations, the prominent Muslim Brotherhood front organization engaged in civilization jihad. Dinah, I have to move on, but suffice it to say, we want to talk more about this with you, specifically with respect to how some of these other foreign powers, notably Russia and China, are also buying into our media, again, seemingly without anybody paying the least bit of attention to it, let alone understanding the political warfare purposes to which these kinds of instruments are, in fact, being put. But before we run out of time with you, Diana, I wanted to turn to a woman who has probably understood this jihadist enterprise, most especially the civilization jihadist element of it, that is to say the so-called nonviolent, actually pre-violent form that we've talked about in the book you contributed marvelously to, Sharia, the Threat to America, namely Michelle Bachmann. She has been savaged now for almost a year for having actually raised an alarm about some of this. What's going on with her at the moment, and what should our listeners be thinking about it and doing?
Well, you have People for the American Way, a leftist advocacy group, actually putting together a petition asking House Speaker John Boehner to remove Michelle Bachmann from the House Intelligence Committee. Now, this actually all ties into what we're talking about already, because Fox has also savaged Michelle Bachmann, specifically going back to last summer when she and her few of her colleagues were raising questions about Muslim Brotherhood penetration into the United States government. Specifically, one of the cause celeb was the perhaps penetration, her question, of the Secretary of State's office with her top aide being Huma Abedin, whom we've spoken about before. And this is one of these
closely tied to the Muslim Brotherhood, both personally
correct.
And through her family.
And indeed, what I found out last week is there is a link going back to the Fox Empire, the Murdoch House of Saud Empire, which includes an Arabic component and News Corp. On the board of one of the most vile of the Arabic stations is one Abdullah Omar Nassif, a Al-Qaeda financier, a senior figure, a senior leading light, if you call it that, in the Muslim Brotherhood, who, if we can tie this together, actually was the sugar daddy and helper and board member of Huma Abedin's family business, the Journal of Muslim Minority Affairs.
Right, and so the Institute of Muslim Minority Affairs, of which it was a part. Correct.
Yes, and so if you actually look at this in terms of degrees of separation, which makes it very linear and not as confusing, you see a connection between this Al-Qaeda financier, Nassif, Murdoch, Al-Waleed, Huma Abedin, and by extension, your favorite Fox cable personalities, because these people are all separated by very few degrees of separation, and the potential for influence, which is really the key weapon of overall penetration and intelligence operations of hostile nations. It is influence. It is not stealing secret plans. It is influence on our thoughts and thinking.
And our policies.
You see the potential.
Yeah.
You see the terrible potential there.
Diana West, we have to leave it at that for the moment. We will be back covering this story. I think what we're really getting at here is Michelle Bachmann is being vilified for having exposed some of that influence operation, penetration problem,
yes.
And she should be, if anything, lauded for it, not taken to task by the red-green axis, as they call it, doing business under the form of the People for the Islamist Way. Diana West, thank you so much for joining us. Keep up the great work with your column. We look forward again to American Betrayal and to talking with you again next week and to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.